listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Well, tonight, we are honored to present Lema Roberta Bowie, the author of the book Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War. We're so honored to present this extraordinary woman's story to you. And when you read this astonishing book, you'll note how both education and literacy were so important to Lema Bowie's ability to organize and move forward in life. Lema Bowie was a 17-year-old girl when the war first came to Monrovia. As she says, she turned from a child into an adult in a matter of hours. For 15 years, Liberia was gripped by civil war between the government of the corrupt and ruthless Charles Taylor and warlords battling to overthrow him. More than 200,000 people were killed, and one out of three were made homeless. Lema came to see that it would be up to the citizens of Liberia, especially its women, to bring the country back from the insanity of civil war. Lema Roberta Bowie helped organize and then lead the Liberian Mass Action for Peace, a coalition of Christian and Muslim women who sat in public protest confronting Liberia's ruthless president and rebel warlords. The movement brought an end to the Second Liberian Civil War in 2003, and Bowie emerged as an international leader. The filmmaker Abigail Disney produced the documentary of the struggle and triumph of Lema Bowie and the Liberian women in her award-winning film, Pray the Devil Back to Hell. And you'll be able to see the entirety of this film in its broadcast premiere Tuesday night, November 8th, as part of a five-part PBS series called Women, War, and Peace. So watch for that. Tonight, Lema will talk about her peace-building work and her own life story. And she will be in conversation with the Reverend Dr. Gwen Guibord, and we are so honored to have Reverend Guibord here with us tonight. She is the founder and president of the Guibord Center, Religion Inside Out. She is known for initiating interreligious dialogues throughout Southern California and beyond. She is the co-chair of the National Muslim Christian Initiative Dialogue on behalf of the National Council of Churches. She's also currently represents the Episcopal Church USA for the NCCC's Christian-Jewish Dialogue, and she's won many, many awards, among them the Muslim Peace Award from the Islamic Center of Southern California, and most recently the Distinguished Alumna Award for 2010 from the Claremont School of Theology.
I want to encourage all of you to buy this book. She's not paying me for saying that to you, but it really is quite an extraordinary journey. It is a memoir of Liberia's descent into madness and of your journey in it, through it, and out of it. But for right now, let us journey together across the continent of North America, across the Atlantic, to the continent of Africa, and in particular to Liberia. America and Liberia have a particular relationship, a particular history together. Would you just speak to that briefly, Lema?
Okay. Thank you all for coming. Miss Carol, Carol Mathers, I call her my therapist because this book was a therapy. Liberia is that country that free slaves from here in the U.S. went to in 1822. And everything about Liberia is like America. So you have our flag, like the U.S. flag, but with one star. Our constitution model, like the U.S. constitution. We have three branches of government, like here. We call the house that our parliamentarians sit in Capitol. We do, like I said, have the Supreme Court with the Chief Justice, just like here. Everything. Some of the streets are named after famous people from here and famous cities. We have a Virginia and a Maryland and different places, and Monrovia is after President James Monroe. So we do have a rich history, and one Liberian woman put it in a very nice context, Liberia, America's stepchild. Mm. Yeah.
What were, I'm always interested when there is the kind of strife that has been so long lasting, was so long lasting in Liberia, of the conditions that may have made that possible. Would you speak to that, please?
Well, when the slaves came to Liberia, the indigenous people, like any other place where you have indigenous people, where, and it's ironical that I'm speaking about it here in California with your own history, were welcoming of the free slaves. They gave them their land, they made them comfortable, and something that is typical of abused people, they don't know how to show gratitude. The only life they knew is the life of abuse. So what had been meted to them on the plantation was what they meted against the indigenous people when they got very powerful. So we had segregated schools. We had everything that people had. So for 100 plus years, indigenous people were the virtual slaves of the quote-unquote descendants of the free slaves. If I may give a quick example, if you had a last name like my last name, many of the people, and if you were fair color like me and aspiring to go to university, some of the free slave descendants who didn't have children would tell you, take my last name, because that last name of yours is not a representation of, you know, people who should come to the university. So those were, they founded a technical school for children of indigenous people because they were preparing them for the life of service to children of the free slaves. Wow.
Throughout the book, your wonderful, wonderful book, you spoke time and again about fear. And I want to read a very short one line, a sentence that is just so wonderful. And I quote, "When you move so quickly from innocence to a world of fear, pain, and loss, it's as if the flesh of your heart and mind gets cut away, piece by piece, like slices taken off a ham. Finally, there is nothing left but bone." Lima, I'd like you to speak to that through the lens about this issue of fear, through the lens of a woman and a mother in Liberia.
Well, first I will step back and speak to that through the lens of a child, because I was a child when the war started, a 17-year-old teenager who had been protected by her community and her family. And you wake up one morning and it's all gone. And you're afraid. The sound of the gun, the absence of your parents, the absence of your siblings, the many relatives coming and telling stories of horrors, the fear is never ending. And I think it's at that point that that peace starts to go away. And then as it progresses, you're praying that this madness will end. I'll go to bed tomorrow and we'll be okay. And you wake up the next morning and it's worse than the day before. A piece has been taken off. And by the time you look at yourself from 17, like myself, I'm 31. And beyond the pains and the scars of the war and the fears of the war, you have the whole issue of violence and all of the different things that you've seen. So it's just one issue after the other. But that fear is something that pushes you back into a space that is difficult to describe. You are afraid. So it takes hope. It takes courage. It takes a lot away from you day by day. And most of the time, people who rain terror on people, that's what they want. Gradually, they are stripping you of your strength. They are stripping you of your willpower. They are stripping you of everything that would ever bring you to the place where you were able to fight back?
And as a mother, I mean, there were times when your children were hungry, they were exhausted. It's unimaginable what that must have been like for you.
You know, sometimes it's difficult to really put it into context. But by the time I started having children, the fear of the guns had gone away. The fear of what could happen to me was gradually going away. It was the fear for their own lives, for the lives of those children. How do they survive in the midst of all of these? And then you get to a place where you realize that I don't have the power to even protect these children because it's not in my power. And then you get numb. And you just sit there. And you can't function. And you can't do anything. If you have faith, you pray. But in my case, I lost faith. So it was difficult to even pray.
And then we have Charles Taylor, who comes on the scene around 1989. And he has his own private army. And one of the most egregious things that he does, in my estimation, is that he has the small boys' army, ages 9 to around 15, who are given guns. They're hopped up on alcohol and drugs, and they commit horrific atrocities. How, because in a way they were a victim also, how have you had to work with yourself to find peace and forgiveness and reconciliation with these kids who have perpetrated such horrific crimes against women and children in particular?
You never really want to think about, the last thing you want to think about when you see child soldiers is to start thinking about reconciliation and peace and how do we make life better for one another. I remember when I started working with those group of young boys in 1998, I would stand there, even as they're raining insults on me, I'm cursing the day they were born and saying, no wonder you have one leg, in my mind. And it's just anger and anger for me. But I was at a place where we have a parable. It says I was at a place, it was like the porcupine intestine. It's too bitter to swallow and too greasy to throw away. I needed to go to school. This was the job for me. And that was the requirement for me to go back to school. So it was bitter to swallow. But then the school was the greasy part that I could not throw away. So I would stay with them, listen to them. But you know, God has his way. As I engage with these children, even through all that facade of men or boys turned to men and vicious killers, you gradually get to see who these people are. Children. Yes. They are still trapped, even at 15, 20, 25. They were still trapped in that moment when they were first given that first drug or the first alcohol. So you see babies who still want their mothers. You see children who even at the place where they now have children, they are, you see children in them. So when you get to know them, when I get to know them and get to see beyond all the macho thing, I feel sorry for them.
Yes.
Because I'm looking at my kid brother, I'm looking at my nephews, I'm looking at my own children, and then I'm looking at myself and saying, they are at the same place that I am. I'm trapped as a 17-year-old, even at 26. And they are trapped as 10, 12, 9-year-old boys, even at 18. You can't help but to want to reach out to them. You can't help because it tears down that wall of anger. And till today, people in Liberia cannot understand why I would stop my car when they hail me. Because I don't see killers. I see children that were exploited and abused. I see myself, had I not come out of my own state of traumatization.
Yes. indeed. You, about that time, as I recall, you started working as a volunteer for an organization, Trauma and Healing Reconciliation Program. And the cycle of fear took on something else. And if you would, Lema, I would love for you to read from your own book, but you must give it back to me. Mine has already been signed, by the way. This opening paragraph, if you would.
When you're depressed, you get trapped inside yourself and lose the energy to take the actions that might make you feel better. You hate yourself for that. You see the suffering of others but feel incapable of helping them, and that makes you hate yourself too. The hate makes you sadder. The sadness makes you more helpless. The helplessness fills you with more self-hate. Working at the Trauma Healing and Reconciliation Program broke that circle for me. I wasn't sitting home thinking endlessly about what a failure I was. I was doing something that actually helped people. The more I did, the more I could do. The more I wanted to do, the more I saw needed to be done.
And this was your introduction to being a peace builder.
This was my introduction to... Yes.
Yes. Okay. And it was about this time that you and the woman who was then your mentor, now she's become a beloved friend, Thelma.
Ikea.
Thank you. You began a training manual for women where you didn't teach women, but you sought out to transform them. And in this manual, there are wonderful exercises of being a woman, ... Crowns, what are my crowns, what are my thorns? And then there's another wonderful exercise of shedding weight. Yeah. I'd like to ask you two questions about the manual. I know that sometimes you would be up much of the night hearing women's stories. Is there one story in particular that you recall that you would be willing to share with us?
There are many stories that made an impression on me. But I am one person who have always thought that our traditional practices, female genital mutilation, was not as bad as the world made it out to be until we went to Sierra Leone and we formed a circle. I knew this woman who had worked with me for many years, and she is the pillar of strength for her community. And this day when we did this circle, she decided to tell her story. And her story went back to herself as a 7-year-old girl being taken into the traditional Sandy society. And she tells the story about the day she was about to get mutilated. But what I remember about that story was that it took her, she started and in 15 minutes, she got to the place of the mutilation, and then it took her almost 10 hours to progress from that place to the next part of the story. Because she tells that they tied me, and then she goes, and she will scream, ear-piercing scream, where she sat. She dug her feet and her toenails in the earth till she cut her feet. But she didn't know she was doing all of those things. People fell asleep. People woke up. People fell back asleep. And she struggled and struggled. And by morning. So we did that circle in Kenema, Sierra Leone. We had one person start. She was the second. And in a circle of 20 people, she was the only story we heard the entire night. Afterwards, she fell asleep. And it was like all day. She has now started her own organization in that community, fighting off the harmful traditional practices and other issues related to women's rights. But till today, every time I see her, I still remember that ear-piercing scream and her digging her toenails in the earth and fighting back the cries and the pains. And she was in her 30s, but it was the pains, the weight from 7 years old that she had been carrying all of her life.
I have to tell you, that story takes my breath away. It's just, thank you for telling us that. The second question I have about this manual for training is it being used now, currently, in various places of the world?
People use it when they in different places in ways that we don't know anything about. I still make reference to it. I use it when I was in Congo last year with the women. It is, like you said, a very powerful tool.
Right.
When you get to do it, and there is no category of women that you use that crowns or thorns with that it doesn't really speak to them. One of the other parts of the manual, sometimes we try to tilt it a bit, is reaffirming yourself, being a woman, as a woman. And we do different things like the catwalk. We do different things. Like, I remember when we were in Congo, working with all of these women who had experienced war, and asking them to stand up and just describe themselves. It was amazing. Last year, we did it with female ministers in Liberia, and we asked them to stand up and just reaffirm their beauty. One of the female ministers said, "Wow, I've never felt so good in any company because I've never, ever taken out time to compliment myself." So it's not about what spectrum of society you find yourself, from grassroots to middle to top level. Sometimes women are so busy taking care of the world that, and then sometimes our husbands are so busy looking for money that they never really stop to look at you and say, "Girl, you look good." But one of the things that I do to myself all the time is, once I dress, and this is a little bit egotistic, but I still do it, is stand in front of the mirror and say, "Ooh, you look good." So we try to teach our women to appreciate themselves. But I'll quickly move on and say, just give a quick example. One of the trainings we had, we asked rural women, we brought 50 rural women together, and we asked them to write down their dreams, what they've always dreamed about as a woman when it comes to beauty. And there were some of the women, one Muslim woman in the room who forever wore
the hijab.
Yes. She said she had always wanted to wear a blue dress, a red hat, a red pair of shoes, and makeup. Some of the women from highly traditional backgrounds said they've always wanted to wear a pair of jeans. Some said they've always wanted to go to a nightclub. So by the time we finished that session, I was on the phone to every Liberian woman I knew. "Do you have a red hat? Do you have a pair of jeans? Do you have this? Do you have that?" And by the next day, we had a room full with clothes. Those women got dressed, and the first part of their dream was to take them to a nightclub. And we walk in the nightclub, 50 women, and the guy asks, "Is there a birthday party going on?" I said, "No, we just came to have a good time." And then the next day, we did our fashion show. Until this Muslim woman died a year ago, that was the photograph she carried.
Oh my.
Of herself coming down the stairs in a blue dress, red hat, and nicely made up.
Oh, lovely.
And she said, "Before I got married, I was called Edith. And then she got the Muslim name. And she said, this photo is truly Edith." So those are some of the things. But these women, as simple as it may sound, leave that room or leave that space, and they are never the same again when they go back into their communities.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting that you would talk about a dream. Those of us who are in ordained ministry talk about a call, our calling to ministry by God or Jesus or however we want to define it, and you got a call in a crazy dream. Yeah. Would you talk about that?
Well, it was this night I lived by myself, and I would sleep on the cold floor under the window. This is something that you pick up from the wartime because you're afraid to sleep on the bed for stray bullets. So I'm lying there, and I always hear this voice in my dream, and I never see the face saying, "Get up, gather the women, and put them together to pray for peace." I wake up shivering because the window is open and light rain was falling on me. I go to work the next morning and go to a pastor who's my boss and say, "I had this dream, and they said we should gather the women to pray for peace." But you know, BB, they weren't talking about me because my life, I'm in a relationship that I am so fornicating, and it can't be me they're talking about. So you as a pastor, need to identify those women who are living right. And then he said, the dream bearer is the dream carrier. We prayed, and that was the beginning of something called the Christian Women Peace Initiative.
Yes.
And then later on, the Muslim women were inspired to start their group. So that was the beginning of the entire protest that later started in 2003.
That's right. And now, by now, the war is about 13 years.
Yes.
In the making.
Yes.
And people were going in droves to Monrovia.
Yes.
To be in the refugee camps. And the refugee camps were hundreds, thousands of people, a lot of disease, a lot of malaria, people not eating adequately. But yet you have said that it was seeing them and hearing of their experience in Monrovia in the refugee camps that you were baptized into the women's movement because they gave you such hope, they who had lost so much.
You go into a community where people have been raped. One of the women I met from Sierra Leone, who was a refugee in Liberia at the time, was breastfeeding her baby when they got to a checkpoint, and the soldiers cut off that breast. They all had different forms of physical disability, but these women were still saying, "We were the hope. We are the hope for our communities. We will go back and teach these children peace." And here I am carrying my anger from years ago and making more mistakes, even as I was angry. And they asked me, "Have you been raped? No. Have you been abused? No. Why are you such a hypocrite? You know, why are you angry?" And I went home and asked myself that same question. Why am I angry? I'm being a hypocrite. Going back to those women, and they're saying to me, "You know, we are the hope of our communities." That was a moment of baptism for me.
Yes.
Because sometimes you need water and sometimes you need fire.
Right.
To really open your eyes. And I think I got a dose of both from the words of those women.
So that was the beginning of the Women's Peace Initiative.
That was the beginning of my awareness.
Okay.
That, you know, they are right. We are the answer. The Women's Peace Initiative started with Thelma inviting us to Ghana, taking the concept, bringing it back, and starting something. But the Christian women was born before the Women's Peace Initiative. So when we came back from Ghana with that idea, we were using our platform till today, from 2002 till today. Every Tuesday at 12 noon, you'll find the Christian women up in a room at the Lutheran compound. They call it the upper room, praying from 2002 till today, 12 noon, every Tuesday, unfailingly. Even if it's one person, someone is there praying for the peace of Liberia. And they've declared a fast now. And the Women Peace Network is back on the airfield praying for peace now as we speak.
And it was at this juncture that your work started becoming strategic.
More strategic, yes.
Yes. And what I found so compelling is that as you're, by now, Muslim and Christian women are working together, and you looked to the book of Esther.
Yes.
And say something about that, if you will.
Well, when we decided to protest, you could not, Liberia, like any other place, even here, had been divided on social line, status, ideological, everything. And you could not mobilize a group of people to work for peace because every villain in one community was a hero to his people. So you had to really, it was difficult to get anyone. So when we brought these women together, the first thing we had to do was move beyond religion, ethnicity, ideological or political ideologies, and bring us to a place where it was about womanhood. Who cries the most when a baby dies? Who does this the most? Who does that the most? Who are the ones being raped? Then they understood that part. And then before we could even move into, but then you needed the separate group identity. So as Christian women, the thing we were getting was, women had never been involved in these things. So we had to take the Christian women back to the Bible. See Deborah, see Esther. These were revolutionary work that these women did. It wasn't sit down, fast, and pray. They got out there. They put their faces in the forefront of the politics of their time. We went into the Quran. See Khadija, the wife of the Prophet Muhammad. She had a voice. She was not silent. She was not docile, as everyone is saying that Muslim women are supposed to be. And then there was a research that I found on the Islamist perspective of nonviolence and the Christian perspective of nonviolence that I exploited to the core.
Bravo.
But it was that kind of thing that we used. So by the time when we decided to do the fast, it had caught on. And then we said we'll do, the women said, like Esther, sackcloth and ashes. Look at me. On a normal day, this is the way Liberian women dress. And we say, if we continue to dress like this, no one will take us seriously. Nicely dressed, jewelry and everything. So we have to go back to God. We all recognize that we have a role to play in the violence that our communities are facing. So let's go in sackcloth and ashes. The white was symbolic for peace. The hair tie was to cover the beauty of the hair. No shoes, no jewelry, no makeup, and God has a sense of humor. At that time, we decided and declared that fast and prayer. I had one of the funkiest haircuts in all of Liberia, and I had to cover my haircut. Now that we have peace, I have to redo my haircut. But that was how the Christian women approached it.
Right.
And the Muslim women just bought into it.
So there you are, and your strategy is to gather at the fish market.
Yes.
Because that's where Charles
Taylor Taylor went to work every day.
Right.
People went to work every day. No one passed the airfield without looking right.
Right.
Yes.
So you were out there. Now, imagine this. In the Liberian sun, and then it would rain, and it doesn't get cooled off from the rain.
No.
It gets hotter and humid. And women whose clothing hung on them in the white T-shirts. And you were out there for how many days?
2 years.
2 years. 2 years. But finally, he agreed. Well, in the middle of that.
In the middle of that, we're there for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And then he agreed to go to meet with us.
But somewhere in there, there's a decision about no sex. Now, we have to talk about that.
Well, you know, I wish Asatu was here. the Muslim woman, yes. if you watch, pray the devil back to hell. Because Asatu, sometimes we say, are you really a Muslim? Because you have a devious mind. She was the one coming to us and saying, you know what? We have started this thing, and these men of ours are not writing opinions in the newspapers. They are just silent. So we have to move them to action. How do you suppose we do that? She said, a sex strike. Let's deny them sex. In the urban areas, we failed miserably. We weren't strategic. So we went straight with sex strike. And then some morning, some of the women would come, oh, last night we had a fight. And I had to give in. In the rural areas, the women called their husbands into the church and said, we are at a point where we need to seek God's face for peace. We are fasting, we are praying. And you know, the whole thing of fast is denying yourself the pleasures. We've come to you to tell you that as we journey, take this journey, it means no sex. They agreed. So for months, nothing. And then they said some days they will go to fast and the husbands will be sitting there and fasting along with them. But when we ended the protest after 2 years, in the rural community, Totota, specifically our central Liberia place, we saw a thing of men walk down with gifts and flowers. These are rural men.
They're courting.
And they come to appreciate their wives publicly.
Lovely.
And then one of them leaned over and says, it's all about the sex. Because today we end, today we have sex. But they were more strategic. But that sex strike was a way of, and it really, like here, caught the attention of the media, caught the attention of the men, and it was a buzz. There was a buzz in town. For almost a week, people were talking about this sex strike and this sex strike and this sex strike. Yeah. Well, we had not read the Greek play. We had no
idea. I know,
no,
that's
idea.
The amazing thing that you didn't know about Lysistrata.
No,
yeah.
No.
Now, somewhere in there, it's decided to have a position statement and
yes.
take it to Parliament. And finally, Charles Taylor agreed to meet with you.
Yes.
And there is this extraordinary scene of hundreds of women at your back, literally. You're up on a stage, and they are praying for you to be steadfast in intention and also for Satan not to interrupt this process.
Yes.
And with a steady hand and a steady voice, you present this position paper to President Taylor. And it's after that that he agrees to go into peace talks in Ghana.
Yes.
And you continued that strategy at the peace talks where the warlords, other presidents of other countries in Africa, of course, Taylor, and you kept getting the women there in their white, and you were very strategic about that. The peace talks, it's like the guys were having a good time. They were at Club Med.
If you are making $1,000 a day, do you want to end?
No, I don't think so. Not when you've come from such deprivation.
Yes.
But they were all continued to jockey for power. Yeah. You then took the women into the hall and create that scene for us, Lema. It's just extraordinary.
Well, we went to Accra with 7 women and mobilized the refugee women. We thought in our minds that we're going for a week. We stayed for 3 months. The talks were going nowhere. The violence had increased. I had lost faith in the power of nonviolence. I was constantly crying. At some point, I stopped joining the women to protest. And this morning, I go to the offices of the West Africa Network for Peace Building, and I'm watching the Yahoo video. and they gave a news flash of this missile that landed. And these two little boys were brushing their teeth. All that left of those boys were their slippers. They were crushed. A young girl had just given birth and came outside to hang the baby's clothes. She was crushed. So on that video, the mother is holding this one-day-old child and saying, "What do I do?" And I'm sitting watching this video, and the anger is just welling up. And I think all of the anger from 17 years old came back, and the tears is running down. I go into one of the rooms, and they have some of the white T-shirts. I put it on, go to the peace talks, and say to Sugars, "Do we have money?" She said, "Yes." Say, "Send for more women." And then she said, "Lema, what is it?" I said, "I'll tell you later." The press people were about to leave, and I went to them and said, "You have a story today." And they said, "What is it?" I said, "Just don't leave." We get word that the warlords and the mediators were going into session at 10 o'clock. So I separate myself from the group, sit at a table, and write my hostage letter. Wrote the letter, folded it, and by the time I got through writing the letter, the women had arrived. The people were going into the rooms. I went to the women and said, "Sit down and loop arms like this." And at that time, no one had any clue of what we were going to, what they were doing. They were just taking instructions. And then I tapped on the door of the peace hall, and one of former Nigerian general turned, and then I said, "I want to see you." He said, "Me?" I said, "Yes." He came. I gave him the letter, and he took it to the mediator, and he read it. And the only thing he said on the overhead speaker was, "Oh, my God, General Lima and her troops have seized the peace hall." But as we seized the hall, then the police come, and they say, "You are obstructing justice."
And you went off.
Totally.
Totally.
My life flashed past before me. My socialization flashed past before me. I had been brought up to believe that the men of this world protect the women and the children. And if I'm being accused of obstructing justice, and all I'm trying to do is deliver a semblance of justice to my people, I felt like there is no hope. This is the depth, because just imagining myself in handcuffs was the depth of humiliation, rape, abuse, death, destruction. You've seen all for 14 years. So I just said, "You know what? I'll make it easy for you. I'll strip naked." And someone asked, "So what? In a country where women have been raped, would you say stripping naked would have done?" I was protesting the pain of every woman. When you're being raped, your clothes are torn off you. When you are protesting in pain, you are giving away the last shred of your integrity. And that was what I was doing in protest. Take it. Take my integrity. Take what is left of womanhood. For every Liberian woman, take it. If this will bring peace,
right,
take it.
And when you took off the head covering?
Took off the head cover. Every Liberian woman you see with this on have something like a short pants under it because of the war.
Right.
So we are still traumatized. I'm in America and I still carry it. Take off the skirt, the wrap. And this man run, this Liberian man, and put it back on and say, "Don't do this." But on my left, Sugars, who's my mentor, has already started stripping also. And they are saying, "Don't do this." But the security men who came to arrest us understands the African culture.
Yes.
They run. So someone said they were running from our bodies. Or they run away.
But that began to turn it around.
It turned it around 100%.
Right.
It turned it around for us. Because at that time, when they negotiated with us to leave that space,
we understood that we too had power. Mm-hmm. So the message on our placards became more vicious and more bold. We were referring to them as killers. Whereas in the past, we were saying, give us peace. And then they who used to walk cocky and arrogant would walk very soberly as they passed by us. No more insults were thrown at us. In 3 weeks, a peace agreement was signed.
Right. And it... a transitional government was put in place. You have said, and I agree with you, that ultimately goodness wins out over evilness. But there's a price to pay. And I would like for you, from your book, to read the price that was paid right here.
A war of 14 years doesn't just go away. In the moments we were calm enough to look around, we had to confront the magnitude of what had happened to Liberia. 250,000 people were dead, a quarter of them children. One in three were displaced, with 350,000 living internally displaced persons camps, and the rest anywhere they could find shelter. 1 million people, mostly women and children, were at risk of malnutrition, diarrhea, measles, and cholera because of contamination in the wells. More than 70% of the country's physical infrastructure, our roads, hospitals, and schools, had been destroyed. The psychic damage was almost unimaginable. A whole generation of young men had no idea who they were without a gun in their hands. Several generations of women were widowed, had been raped, seen their daughters and mothers raped, and their children killed and be killed. Neighbors had turned against neighbors. Young people had lost hope, and old people, everything they had painstakingly earned. To a person, we were traumatized. We had survived the war, but now we had to remember how to live. Peace isn't a moment. It is a very long process.
It is through what you did that you were largely responsible for the election of the first woman president of Nigeria,
Of Liberia.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and you are going to be going back to your country within a few days.
So what?
She is up for election again.
Yes, next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday. And what do you think her chances are?
I'm going to open my big mouth and say she's going to have a win.
We're going to turn over for questions, but I do want to ask you one more question, Lema, if I may. You have done so much, and you have sacrificed greatly, and you have paid a price. Would you be willing to speak to that for a moment?
Well, I really don't think I've done anything. Just today, I was having a conversation with a friend, and I said to her, it was not until I watched Pray the Devil Back to Hell that I felt like we had done anything significant. In my mind, till today, it was a survival tactic, fighting for the future of our children. And I would have been content if we didn't get on a big screen. You know, I feel like you said earlier, I'm called to do what I do. I don't have any sense of, wow, I'm doing a great work. Every time I go to a space and do something, I leave that space thinking, did I really do good? Am I really making impact? And it's only with the young people that I engage with in the community, women, sometimes, and I saw a documentary that was done in Uganda with some rural women, and one of them said, the first time I looked at that little girl called Lema, I said, if she can do it, I too can do it. And I was like, what? So I'm at a place now where all I want is the opportunity to do my work, do what I know to do best, encourage people to maximize their potentials. And the sacrifices, I don't think I've made any sacrifice. I think I have just lived. I don't think, and the pains that I've gone through, I see it as the only way that I could have, that was my empowerment phase to do what I do now. I don't think of myself as anyone great. So when I go to places, I try to ask people to kindly just say, I'm a mother of six, because that's the only thing that gives me so much pleasure. And that I'm a peace and women's rights activist. That's so I'm content. I am so content with where I find myself. I'm content with the work that I do. If I don't become the Secretary General of the UN or a President of Liberia or any other thing, I'm just content working in my community. I'm just content being who God has called me to be. I will not, I don't begrudge him for any of the trials that I've gone through in life. I don't see any of the achievements that I've gotten as a right. I see it as God's favor. Yeah.
Thank you both for that beautiful conversation. Before we open it up to you, with your permission, we'll see an excerpt from Pray the Devil Back to Hell. Please, Russell, let's try it.
Do we need to move?
I think you're fine. Okay.
All right.
Men of Substance do not abuse women.
We are fed up with the war.
They thought that none of us would survive to tell the truth. You cannot take our land away from us.
To the Bible, we saw what Esther did for her people, that she went in sackcloth and ashes, saying, I mean it.
Liberian women that love to do their hair and put on jewelry and makeup were not allowed to do any of those things.
We wore plain white clothes with the hair tie. We wore the white, saying to people we were out for peace. We are determined, and nobody gonna deter us. We gonna find a strategic point where Taylor gonna encounter us and give us some attention. And this is how we decided to sit at the fish market every day. Thousands of women, including ITPs, internally displaced persons, went. It was the first time in our history in Liberia where Muslim women and Christian women were coming together.
And we had a big banner that said, the women of Liberia want peace now.
Charles Tillot said, those who think they can come out in the street to embarrass themselves, come out. I'm waiting for you. I said nobody, N-O-B-O-D-Y, nobody will get into the street to embarrass my administration.
We were not afraid. My mother was like, they will beat you people or they will kill you. And we said, well, if I should get killed, just remember me that I was fighting for peace.
Frontline discussion of wars, and this is what the newspapers report on: the fighting tactics, the troops, the politics, the borders, the weapons, the armies, all of these things. That is a men's story. The backline discussion of the story is how you actually exist and live and continue on living in war. That's a woman's story. And that story has never been told.
Warfare is a very different proposition now, in which civilians are not, quote, collateral damage, as we once called them, but really very much in the center of the war zone.
The ordinary civilians are the ones who feel the brunt from the hunger, they watch their children die, the women are the ones raped, and then after conflict, when the wars or the end of the wars are being negotiated, they are never considered.
Women say, stop violence! Stop violence! Stop violence!
I think it's way past time that we redefine what we mean by war, because there are no front lines in the wars in today's world. The fact is that in today's wars, the primary victims are women and children.
Thank you so much for everything. I'll be thanking you when I pray. Thinking about literacy, I work in literacy in LA, in at-risk communities. When you were getting the women together, you know, people that are traumatized because of what's going on, the danger, did you all do any reading? Or if you did, what did you read? Thank you.
When we started the work, I think we would say in terms of people, women had different skills. And I was the only one who had a tiny bit of skills around peace building. And I had read Gandhi. I read King. And I was mesmerized by the power of nonviolence. For a long time, I felt like that was the most powerful way of life. There was nothing more powerful. So those were the things that I read. But we also, when we talk issues of nonviolence, we ask women to give us stories of acts of nonviolence in their communities. And there were different stories that came up that really spoke to what we felt we were doing. So we didn't do a lot of theoretical things. It was not until after we did this work, when I went to do my graduate study, that I would read, we were doing a course called Strategic Peace Building. And then I was, we did that. Was that strategic? We did this. That was strategic. Is that a tactic or a strategy? You know, all of those jargons that are used in the actual peace building thing. But yes,
You just read a letter of King and Gandhi. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I'm struck as you were, I was struck while you were talking about your sense of community and how you women could see what was happening in your community. In our country, we're at war all the time in other places. So right now in Libya, there's a siege of Sirte that's been going on for weeks. People barely know about it. People there don't have food, they don't have water. They're getting bombing sorties every day. But we don't internalize that because this is not part of our community or in Iraq or in Afghanistan. So I guess I'm wondering, how does one create a larger world community where we care and we can wear white and we can object to these wars and we care about other people in other parts of the world?
You know, I have come to a very cynical place when it comes to us versus them, the world, your world, my world. And your question is a good question. But your question can be answered in two ways. You first said you in your community, you see the wars. Open your eyes. In this community, you will see the wars also. It's here. It's happening. As a stranger, I see it. And I think the connections between your world and my world, and I will cross that out and see the connections in our world, is our ability to move beyond, I want to help there. And start with, I want to help here. That's one. Libya, Egypt, Tunisia is not short of activists. What they are short of is resources. Liberia, Congo. The stories you've heard from Congo, I was in Congo. Congo is not short of activists. What they are short of is resources. This country has resources. What you are short of is activists. If you put me in a tiny community in this country, I'll give myself a year and I would have created a community. I went to EMU, and I'm not kidding you. When you learn to exist in a community, you cannot exist without a community. My sister died in June of 2006. I came back to school in the U.S., in August of 2006. She died when I was driving her to the hospital, and I drove around with her body in the car for 3 hours and could not cry because I was looking for a place to put that body. I came back to school and determined that I will not live an isolated life. So the first thing I did was identify every African. And there was not a single Liberian among those Africans. The next thing I did, those Africans were always hungry. My apartment always had food. A community had started. The next thing, the African-American men started coming. The Arabs came. And before you knew it, I was being called Big Mama or Mother of Peace. I used the resources that I saw in America to create my sense of community. Today, I can proudly say, if I landed in Afghanistan, I would go straight to the Swedish embassy because the political analyst there is a young man called Pawis, and he would give me a place to sleep. If I went to Yemen, I will go to the U.S. Embassy, because one of their strategists there is a man called, his name has escaped me. He will give me a place to sleep. My world has shrunk. When they had the bombing in Uganda during the World Cup, the first thing I'm on the internet, Nelson, are you okay? Because I know you are a football lover. I have an African-American young man who works in D.C. now, had his first child, and they said this is your first grandchild because of that community. To create a community is not difficult. I went to a talk the other day, and an old lady said to me, how do you? I said, ma'am, do you see those sassy girls passing up and down in your neighborhood as you sit on your porch? She said, yes, I see them. I said, those girls are going up and down because they are looking for you to recognize them. I said, just try it. Call one and say, I want you to be my friend. She will go and come, and I give you a space of 3 months. The stories that her mother will never hear, you will hear it. So to come back to your question, let's start from here and let's connect our world. How can we do that? How can you use your platform of activism here to influence the need for resources in Libya? There's so much to do here. There is so much to do here. There is so much to do here.
A friend of mine gave me the Chain the Devil Back to Hell, and he gave it to me. He said, you're going to really love this. I'm so honored to be in your presence. Very honored to be in your presence. I'm a community activist, and I live in the war zone in South Central, and I'm a promoter of peace. I've been part of a world peace organization. I'm just really honored to be in your presence. But what I would like, you know, I would like to invite you to come to our community for a year. Okay. And I really want to focus. My mother raised me in the sisterhood consciousness when I was very young. Okay. And the training manual, how can I get a hold of that and, you know, help, you know, the women to, you know, be all that they can be? I mean, Help us.
I'll drop you my card and see if we can, if we have an email copy, a PDF copy that I can send to you.
Thank you. Very nice to hear you speak, and I can't wait to read your book. It seems like you really tapped on something there, or tapped into something there. Do you think that worldwide, if a sex strike took place, that maybe this could really improve the entire world?
No. But worldwide, if a change of mindset about sex took place, it would change the entire world. My sister lives in New York, and every time I come, we find time to hang out. So this day, we're just flipping through the pages of a magazine, and they were advertising a watch. And there is a young man sitting in his underwear, and the watch is on his tie. So then I said, Father, which part of his body is going to wear this watch? I don't understand the connection with a man in brief and a wristwatch on his ties. Unless there's a new way of wearing watch in the U.S. that I don't know about. But the objectification of young boys and girls as sex objects is destroying the next generation of leaders. when young men see young women, they don't see brains anymore. They see from here to here. And young women believe that I don't need brains as long as I have from here to here. It is a sad state. I have a young white niece, and we had a conversation, a friend of mine, over the weekend about it. Where on college campuses now, in the U.S., kids are just hooking up. There's nothing about relationship. So I keep asking my good friend Abby, what is hooking up? So do they just look at each other and say, let's go and hook up? Is it just then sex? Then sex? Because that's the feeling that comes across. Young people are no more having cordial. There is no more space for let's talk and progress to the next level. It's from here to here. And until we can change it, we're in trouble. And this is a global disease. It's a global disease. Who are the young people that we're rolling back our lives to? The countries and the work that we're doing to? You know, I was talking at the University of California, Santa Barbara yesterday, and we talked about this same issue. And the one question that comes to my mind every time I think about the whole issue of peace and security for women and think about the global media and how sex has taken over is a quote that comes from a research that was done by Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Elizabeth Wren. And in that book, Women, War, and Peace, they did a research project. They say the impact of war or conflict on women's lives is a reflection of the interaction during peacetime. So if our young people, imagine if war took place in this country, what would be the statistics of rape? What would be the statistics of abuse? The other question is, if we continue to objectify young women as sex objects and encourage our young men, so the young women are the prey and the young men are the predators for sex, how do we talk about participation in politics? Because the way the world is functioning now, the world is functioning on one side of his brain. You have all the men in power. So that's one side of the brain. The women are not, they are virtually not in the political space. So that other side of the brain is not functioning. So that's why we have a sick world. You wonder why the economy in this country is this way? It's because it's functioning on one side of the brain. So if we think we have a problem now, and we don't correct that whole thing of sex and the object, because it's all part of the discussion around peace. It's all part of the discussion around security. It's all part of the discussion around equality. And if we don't start addressing it, thank God this is Los Angeles, California, the place where dreams are made. How do we change that image of 12-year-old girls wanting to wear thong? How? It's not the sex strike. It's the strike on the sex industry.
I have gotten the high sign that we need to end our time together tonight. I want to thank the Aloud series and the Los Angeles Public Library for this extraordinary evening. And thank you to all of you who have come tonight. I encourage you to let's be together in community after the formal presentation of this. And to you, Lema Bowie, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you all for coming.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Aaron Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Allowed theme was composed by Larry Karish.